Want more stories in your life without adding to your TBR? That's where Audible comes in. I use it for the original novellas, the Plus catalog like Gianna Rayburn's Veronica Speedwell series, and those audiobook sales that you can beat. Right now, Audible has a special offer for new and returning members. Click the link in the show notes to see what deal you'll get and start listening today. Welcome to the What's Your Next podcast. This is Laura. I am so excited to be back. I'm excited to chat with you about today's book, which is Academic Affair by Jodi McAllister. I really read and enjoyed this book. It's a rom-com, smart romance, which Rena would recommend it. It actually has plot, it has a character development, it has a high concept trope that actually makes it work. This book is set in Australia. It is two academic rivals who have been rivals since undergraduate and have been fighting for positions until their PhD. And they're actually going for a job. Academic jobs are hard to find. As someone who actually worked in academia for about 10 years and left academia, and a year later I was aged out, I understand the really issue. It is a sunk cost fallacy, as Dr. Jodi McAllister explains, because you invest so much time and then you realize, like, holy crap, there's really little to no work. So in this episode, we're going to talk about Academic Affair. We're going to talk about The Bachelor. We're going to talk about popular romance and evolution, specifically with new adult, as well as some Australian and New Zealand authors that you can pick up. This is a great episode to listen to if you love rom-coms. I think this is the episode for you. So tune in and enjoy. Hi, Jodi. Welcome to What's Your Next Podcast.
I am so excited to be here. Thank you for having me.
I am so excited.
When your publicist pitched your book, I actually heard your book from two other people who said, this is a great book. You need to read this. And I read it and I was like, and then your publicist reached out and she was like, hey, this person. I'm like, no way, she's a romance author. She is a research, an academic, popular fiction around romance. So I was like, well, we got to talk. So I am so excited to have you here. So tell us about yourself.
So I have a double life. First of all, as you can probably tell from my accent, I am Australian. I live in Melbourne. By one part of day, I am romance author Jodi McAllister. I have written 8 novels. An Academic Affair, which is about to come out in the US, is my 8th novel. My first 4 were for teenagers, and then I moved into the kind of adult romantic comedy space. But then by other part of day, I am Dr. Jodi McAllister, and I am an academic, like Sadie and Jonah in An Academic Affair. So I study popular romance and genre fiction, kind of the defining questions of my research career. What are the stories we tell about love, and what do those do to the ways that we think? So I've done a lot of work on romance fiction, on soap opera, on reality TV, and I am lucky enough to have spent a lot of time in the field of popular romance studies, and I'm now the vice president of the International Association for the Study of Popular Romance.
Oh my gosh, congratulations. That's exciting. Oh.
It means I've organized a lot of conferences.
And talk about academic research and merits of popular romance and what it looks like, the tropes and the genres. And so you probably have an insider look at the actual, how romance is portrayed, how it has evolved, because it has evolved. Even in the past 10 years, it has evolved, you know.
Oh, massively. Huge evolution in the last 10 years.
Yeah. And so talk to us about, like, some of the components of our research, because you actually wrote about new adults, which is actually something that we don't see that often now. It was big in the 2010s. And then we're seeing it, maybe we're meant to see, but we're not seeing the contemporary space as it was thriving in the 2010s. Talk to us about some of the trends and some of the things you've noticed from the academic research.
I mean, if you want to see the way in which genres develop and are never static, then new adult is a really interesting case study. So it started out as this term that was coined by one publisher. It was St. Martin's in 2009. Basically, this is when YA was really huge. We were in peak Twilight, peak Hunger Games at this point. And they were like, oh, a lot of the people reading YA are not actually teenagers. They are a little bit older. And they were like, what if we made even more money off them? And so they initially conceived of new adult as kind of YA but older, so targeting 18 to 24, a generation they were calling Gen Y at that time, millennials they were going after. I like to think in the TV show Younger, the millennial print, the imprint, is kind of exactly what they were trying to do there. And they had kind of no genre restriction on it. It was like YA but older. So they were conceiving of like new adult fantasy, new adult crime, new adult anything you can think of. So they held this contest and it was very well publicized, but as far as I can tell, and I looked pretty hard, they never actually published anything out of this contest and it just kind of quietly went away. But this term, which a lot of people really hated, interestingly, got picked up by readers and started getting applied in reader spaces like Goodreads to some other books. And then overwhelmingly, it started getting applied to dual perspective, first person, contemporary romance. And so this is where we get Colleen Hoover from. She was one of the first big new adult authors. They started making the New York Times bestseller list, even though they were only self-published in ebook, like it was bananas. So there was this huge boom. And then, like all booms do, it went away. And then the term new adult entered a little bit of an identity crisis. And I'm not sure it's ever really re-emerged from that identity crisis. So I published my book on it in 2021, and if I did an updated version, I think I would have to do another chapter on the way that the term has been mobilized on TikTok, but I would have to do a lot more research to think about how that works. But is like one little section of my research from 2021.
It's fascinating because I remember reading romance in the 2016, so there was like a lot of the romance actually became popular in the post-2020 market. Her deal, Colleen Hoover, Akatar, this boom of like these books are now what's popular in the market. And then I haven't seen the market even go back to, and like they're just republishing old work. They're not actually creating new work in that age group or that kind of genre, which is interesting.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot of rejacketing going on. So which I understand from like a commercial standpoint. If something is popping off, of course, you want to capitalize and recapitalize on something you already own.
Yeah. And also, like, I know this from publishing, there's like a push from YA, from us millennials who are reading YA in the 2010s, to read contemporary romance, to read the rom-coms. And there was like a push with the covers, like the way trade paperbacks were coming on, moving away from the mass market, moving away from the men, the rip bodies and the covers. Because they wanted that market to grow, to age out of the YA space and to actually read those books. And now reading the younger audience actually reading these books, which is a lot of it's marketing. A lot of it's they're trying to just get more people to read.
I mean, I think you see the same thing in romanticy as well. A lot of the people reading that now perhaps historically would have been conceived of as YA readers. So like, and YA is maybe in a little bit of a dip at the moment, but things are never going to stay the same. Like that romanticy bubble will pop. Eventually, something new will rise to take its place. All things ebb and flow in time.
Yes. All right. So you also watch reality TV as part of your job.
Yeah, I do.
We got to talk about The Bachelorette. Do you have thoughts about Taylor Frankie Paul being The Bachelorette?
Do I have thoughts about Taylor Frankie Paul being The Bachelorette? I will be interested to see how it goes. So I obviously am familiar with American The Bachelor, but the franchise that I know the best is Australian The Bachelor.
Okay.
And we did this kind of experimentation in the late 2010s of, instead of getting leads from previous casts, we started casting minor celebrities.
Yeah.
And it paid off in the short term. So the seasons they had with minor celebrities like, oh, this will mean nothing to your American audience, but Sophie Monk from The Girl Band Bardot, Nick Honeybadger Cummins, who was a rugby player. In the short term, those seasons rated really well. But then when they couldn't get new leads to kind of match that level of fame, it really fell off.
Yeah.
So I am interested to see whether this marks kind of a new era in casting for US The Bachelor, whether they're going to go with this minor celebrity model, which can really give you short-term gains, and then kind of return to their tried and tested casting someone from the previous season who we already have an emotional investment in model, or what they're going to do. Yeah. I mean, I'm thinking less about American The Bachelor at the moment and more about Australian The Golden Bachelor, which has just started here and which is so far a little bit dull, but I'm hoping it will liven itself up.
Our film The Bachelor was a little more heartwarming. I think I watched like a couple episodes. I was like, oh, this is heartwarming and stuff. But, you know, I actually did not stick around. So maybe there's a lot of time. I think just trying to get the older market to it. But we live in an age of society too, which actually doesn't help the worst of trauma laugh. Like, are you here for being an influencer to do the right reasons?
I have to confess, I am a tiny bit exhausted with The Bachelor at the moment because before An Academic Affair, my previous three books were a trilogy on the same season of a reality dating show, which was basically The Bachelor. So that's here for the right reasons. Can I steal you for a second and not here to make friends? And I think when you write three books about a subject, you're like, maybe I need a little break now. Maybe I've OD'd on the peninsula and I need to just like take a step back.
So I also want to tell us about the three true book series so they can actually get a taste out.
Contestants,
underline, 20 contestants. They can leave the show.
So they're also on the same season of, it's called Marry Me Juliet, but it's The Bachelor, essentially. And the twist this season is that no one is allowed to leave the set, even eliminated contestants. So the first book is a romance between, he's called the Romeo in this universe, but he's the Bachelor, a man named Dylan, and a contestant he eliminates on the first night. The second book is a romance between two contestants who fall in love with each other instead of with Dylan from the first book. And then the third book is a romance between the series villain, Lily Fireball, and her producer. And so because they all take place at the same time, you can technically read one, you can read them out of order, but it's like Rashomon style storytelling. Yeah. So if you read them together, you read them in order, they kind of fit together like a puzzle box and unlock a little bit. And also, like, close readers of Not Here to Make Friends, the third book in the trilogy, will spot a tiny little crossover to an academic affair, just a tiny little one in the deep background.
I love when authors tell it. So talking about reality dating, do you have a preference outside of The Bachelor? We got Love Island. We got other franchises. I'm assuming in Australia, I love Love Island. Personally, I'm more a Love Island kind of girly because I don't care about the marriage part. I like the idea of dating around and trying to figure out who you want to be. And you're just idiots at 20 years old and you're not making like right decisions. And that's not just making decisions and it's just fun. Yeah. A little bit. Do you have any other preference or like taking a break from The Bachelor or you're taking a break altogether and just watching other things?
So the biggest franchise by far in Australia is Married at First Sight, but that is, the Australian version is notorious if you haven't seen it, but not for romance, more for people throwing wine glasses at each other.
Yeah.
But my favorite reality dating format, you can get it on Netflix, it's a Japanese one. So it's called Ainori, which means love bus or love wagon. And they essentially put seven people on a little bus together and they travel around the world and they can talk about anything except their feelings. And then if one of them wants to, the verb is kokokusuru, to confess their love to one of the other contestants, they have to go to the bus driver and ask for permission. And so they confess their love to the person and then the person has the night to think about it. And then they give their answer the next morning. And if they're like, yes, I love you too, they both go back to Japan together. Or if they're like, no, sorry, I don't love you, they stay and only the person who confessed goes back to Japan. And then they introduce more people. So there's always seven contestants on the bus. But they've also pioneered this version with older people, like older 35 to 60, where instead of traveling in a bus around the world, they're renovating a house together. Wow. It's called Ainosato, Love Village. And I'm like, this is perfect because what do middle-aged people love more than home renovations? But also there is a lot of scholarship that tells us that the best way to like form a relationship with someone is to do a project together, to build something together, to make something together. And I was like, what? A reality dating show that's actually conducive to forming relationships? What a wonderful idea. And I am not a crier in reality television, but I have wept during this show so many times. It's so beautiful.
Oh my gosh, thank you so much. And I've heard about Married at First Sight and the Australian version is the superior version that you want to watch just because of the mess.
I don't know if it's superior, but it is.
That's why it's superior. Because it's a mess. It's like, what are we watching? Personally, I got into Love After Lockup. This is an American show where it's prison penthouse and they come out of lockup and they're trying to make it work. And it just makes you question your life choices. Not being, I'm like, thank you, Jesus. I'm not going to a penthouse browser. But it just had a lot of questions and just a lot of like, why are we having this reality TV show? Why are people doing this? Are they here for the right reasons? It comes back to that question.
I mean, I feel very confident that no one on Australian Married at First Sight is there for the scare quotes right reasons. They are there for the drama.
Yes. So let's talk about An Academic Affair, which is the setup, the first chapter. We hear Jonah. We hear Jonah's first intake of telling you he's been a rival with there, and there basically he has a crush on her, but he likes to fight with her. And it's just like the right setup of rivals to lovers. Like they're just like in forced proximity, they share a class together. They're actually are both in academia. They both graduate at the same time. They do have some grades, but they have like actual problems of not just trying to get a job and trying to figure out. And you're seeing them like the explosion of the banter, the chemistry there, and the fighting for the feelings. And they have to work together until in the world of academia, which is a terrible and a great place to be. It's terrible to find a job. I used to work in academia. I used to work in the university setting, and it's the job market is dire.
It's brutal. It's brutal out there.
You have to move to middle of nowhere. You have like no choice. You're competing with hundreds of people. You're trying to make it work. And then you're at will at some point, like cuts or specific to reviews. And so you probably have imparted some of your wisdom from being in this world into this novel. And you have this like pretty smart, blood-rich novel that it gives you kind of like a taste of like the runners to lovers in a setting that you probably wouldn't think of because they have to come with a package deal.
Yeah. So everything that happens to Sadie and Jonah in this book, university wise, has either happened to me or someone that I know, with the exception of the fact that they enter into a marriage of convenience. But honestly, when I was on the job market, if someone had come to me with this proposal, I would have very seriously thought about it because, like, for context, the year I got my permanent job in academia, only 5 were advertised in the whole of the country. So it is, and I had, there were not 5 applicants. There were a lot of applicants. Like, it is a 9th fight. And academia is an industry where there is a real sunk cost. Like, you have to go through so many years of schooling and training to be able to get to the position where you can even enter the job market. And yeah, then the thought that you might not make it, that you might leave, that you might have to go and do something else when this is all you've ever done and all you know how to do is terrifying.
Yeah.
And this is the position that Sadie and Jonah find themselves in at the beginning of an academic affair. So they've been rivals ever since they were 18, and they got into a fight about the Wordsworth poem To Joanna in a first year English tutorial. Did that also ever happen to me one time? Do I still have some deep feelings about this poem? Who could say? It's very mysterious. So they're rivals all through their undergrad, they're rivals all through their PhDs when they're competing for all the same kind of teaching, research, grant opportunities, etc. Then they graduate, they're still competing for all these same opportunities, but now they don't even have the protection of their PhD stipends. So they are broken, they are desperate, and they both really need this perfect job when it comes up. And one of them gets it, I won't tell you which one, but yeah, then their solution is, oh look, this contract has a provision for partner hire. We can both have this if we get married. And initially I intended to do it as a fake dating book, but then I looked into what happens when you do partner hire in Australia and you have to sign a legal document about the nature of your relationship. And if they said they were dating and they weren't, they could go to jail. And I didn't really want that on the table for them. But if they said they were married and they were, none of that is a lie. So no jail for Sadie and Jonah. And that's how we ended up at academic rivals to lovers, marriage of convenience.
Which is like a fan favorite. I gotta tell you, marriage of convenience is a fan favorite of people love the marriage of convenience, especially contemporary. Because it's like, what's going to cost you to get married to someone? You have some withheld insurance, it'll be inheritance, it'll be a trust. And I think in this way, like in Australia, it's a job. It's a job that you're not going to lie, you're not going to end in jail. Like, well, better way, you're avoiding to be a love after welcome experience.
Yeah, and it's really important to me when you use a high concept trope like that, that the reason is really solid. Like, I get a little bit frustrated when it's like, oh no, we have to enter into a fake relationship because I have to go to this one wedding, and if I don't have a date, then my life will explode. And it's like, no, it won't. The worst that will happen is that you'll get asked a few pointed questions about why you're still single. This is not there are so many better answers to your question. Yeah. So when I see a high concept trope like this used in a way where I'm like, yes, that is genuinely the only solution to your problem, it makes me really happy.
Yeah. So Academic Affair is coming out in November for all readers, and it's definitely one that you must add to your books to read. So awesome. Jody, talk to us about what kind of books you tend to read. I know you read for work, romance for work, but what do you like to read? Maybe other than romance, you have the time. Simply, you may not have the time.
I mean, I have to read a lot of romance for both of my careers, basically. You have to read what you write. Like, there's no way around that. If you want to be a good writer, you have to kind of keep up with what's going on in the field. But I also like to kind of broaden my horizons out of my, like, my little genre of contemporary rom-com and read a little bit more broadly. One rule I have for myself is that while I read a lot of contemporary rom-com, I don't read in the very, very specific niche that I'm writing in while I'm writing that book. So when I was writing my reality TV trilogy, I wasn't reading other reality TV romance. Now, writing this academic book, I was like, sorry, I have to put a moratorium on Ali Hazelwood. I can't be reading this right now.
Yeah.
But I was still reading a lot of contemporary rom-com. One rule I have for myself is that I make sure at least one third of my romance reading every year is by authors from Australia and or Aotearoa New Zealand. Because as I'm sure you can imagine, in a kind of smaller market like ours, we tend to get we get a lot of international stuff. And a lot of it is great, but I feel really passionate about supporting local stories in my market. And we have so much great romance here that sometimes doesn't get a shot. And I know now that I'm starting to build a little bit of a platform, it's really important to me to bring other local authors, other Australians, Kiwis, along with me.
So talk to us as Australian and Kiwi authors. Like, give us like some recommendations for our listeners, because we do have international listeners here. And also, we can also get books from Australia, although tariffs are different, but we can get ebooks. We can try to figure out. So give us recommendations to get started. Like, which should you
want? Absolutely. So my number one all-time favorite romance author, I would die for her, I love her so much, is a Kiwi author called Lucy Parker, who has been around for about 10 years now, I think. She's got two series. Her very first book, which she wrote under a different name, is set in New Zealand. And I really wish she'd write some more set in New Zealand because I love that book so much. But predominantly, she writes books set in the UK. So her first series, it was the London Celebrity series, is all set in and around the world of the West End in Britain, in theatre, and it's chef's kiss. And then her second series, which I can never remember the name of, but the first book is called Battle Royal, and it's one of my favorite romance novels of all time. The protagonists are both hosts on the in-universe version of The Great British Bake Off, and they are rivals, and they have rival bakeries across the street from each other, and they're both competing to bake the royal wedding cake, but it's like a perfect grumpy sunshine. They fall in love, and it's just, oh, so good. I love Lucy Parker with all my heart and soul. Also from Aotearoa New Zealand, if you like kind of like whimsical, magical, historical vibes, India Holton is wonderful. Her Ornithologist's Field Guide to Love is probably my favorite book I've read this year. Along that same vibe, that kind of whimsical, magical, historical, moving to Australia, Freya Mask is incredible. So A Marvelous Light is probably her best known book, but she has written a bunch. She had a little novella come out just this week, last couple of weeks, called Cinderhouse, which is a Cinderella retelling, and it is incredible. Then, what else? There are so many queer rom-coms I've read recently. In Spite of You by Patrick Lenton is this like queer revenge rom-com. The tagline is, don't get mad, get hot and get even. After the Siren by Darcy Green is set in the world of AFL, Australian Rules Football, and it is a romance about two guys that end up on the same team and they don't like each other. Maybe they love each other. Oh my goodness. Love Unleashed by Melody Sayward is about a young Indigenous woman who moves to New York with the hope of writing for the Paris Review, but the only job she can get is in a doggy daycare. And she has a few like loves along the way. And the one that she ends up with is just like chef's kiss perfection. Smart Girl's Guide to Second Chances by Steph Weiser just came out. It's the best use of the love triangle trope I've ever read. Claire Fletcher and Karina May are another two brilliant Australian rom-com authors that also have a great podcast called That Rom-Com Podcast. I could go on and on. I have some big feelings about local romance.
I love these recommendations. Thank you. Because I'm like, I read Lucy Parker and now I'm like, in India Bolton, I love that. Yeah. He actually has been on the show too. So I'm like,
oh, wow.
Yeah, so these are awesome, like, to have, like, you know, like, have, like, new authors to discover and new people to look for. Because I aspire to go to Australia at some point. And like, just the aspiration, just to go and just to experiment. And it's like, actually, the books is like to transport you to that, which is like the best, like cheapest travel expense you can have.
I could recommend like the quintessential Australian romance to you.
Yes.
The one that I think really like, to me, is like, okay, this is what love looks like in Australian culture. I've done quite a lot of like academic thinking about kind of love in Australia versus love in the US and how afraid of feelings we are in Australia compared to the US. Well, there is a book called Five Bush Weddings by Claire Fletcher.
Okay.
And so it's about this woman who is a wedding photographer, and she goes and photographs all these weddings out in the bush. And her, it's a friends to lovers, and her hero's name is Jono, which is a really Australian name. The first time they kiss, he is so overcome with emotion that he drops his meat pie. Like, that's a big deal. And then the big kind of final confession of love, he says, "I love you, dead shit." And I'm like, this is just, I'm like, it's such a like vibe.
Yeah.
And I think it's been optioned as a film, which I'm very excited about. But yeah, if you want a book that is like the epitome of Australian romance, Five Bush Weddings by Claire Fletcher.
I am adding that to my TBR immediately. So, Judy, tell us where you can find online.
So I am on Instagram, is probably the easiest one, at Jodie McAllister, JodieMcAllister. I am technically on TikTok under the same name, but I don't post very much because I feel too elderly for TikTok. And then some of my students found me there. And that was a very, oh no, don't perceive me, experience. And I'm on Blue Sky. If you just look up my name, you'll be able to find me there. And I have a website as well, jodiemcallister.com.au.
Awesome. Thank you, Jodie, for being on the show.
It's absolutely my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to The What to Read Next. For more book lists, cozy reads, and library tips, visit thewhattoreadnextblog.com. Your next great read might be waiting there. Are you an author, publisher, or book-related business looking to reach passionate readers? What to Read Next podcast is a perfect place to connect with an engaged audience of romance and mystery lovers who are always on the hunt for their next great read. Now, we're offering sponsorship opportunities. Whether you're launching a new book, promoting an upcoming release, showcasing a bookish product or services, we can help you get the word out. Let's work together to bring your books or businesses to readers who are ready to discover something new. Please visit whatyoureadnextblog.com/sponsorships to learn more or reach out to chat about the perfect sponsorship or package for you. Thank you much for listening. Your next great reader is waiting for you.